Hello and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Marcus Stevens, and today we are joined by Dr. Jen Pond. Jen is currently based in British Columbia, but has worked globally over the course of her career, including on all seven continents. Jen trained at Newcastle Medical School before completing her GP training. Following this, she spent the best part of a year in the foothills of the Indian Himalayas, providing primary care services and working with local women's groups. The Himalayan theme continued with the following year spent working with Himalayan Rescue Association on the Everest Base Camp Trail. Next came rural Zambia, combining unlimited safaris and some pretty exotic medicine, including anthrax, a measles outbreak, and hippo attack trauma. Over the following years, Jen returned to the Himalayas several times, working at Everest Base Camp with Everest ER, a team led by Luan Freer, a name that many of you will be familiar with. Following this, she worked in various remote and rural spots in the Scottish Highlands and New Zealand, before taking on a role working in Antarctica, supporting a range of expeditions. Jen is now based in Canada and works predominantly in Nunavut with the Indigenous Canadian Inuit population. This role combines primary care, emergency medicine, and infectious disease management, often single-handedly in incredibly remote locations with limited resources. I imagine everyone listening is very excited to hear more about Jen's fascinating career, as I am. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get going. Welcome to the podcast, Jen.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. So we're going to talk about various things you've done, but perhaps initially you could take us back to your time at medical school, maybe at GP training. What were you looking ahead to doing? Did you have many plans at that stage?
Honestly, Marcus, I don't think I did, especially not during medical school. We weren't ever really introduced to the idea of a career outside of the box. It was very much complete medical school and choose your specialty training. And that was the natural progression. And I don't think I'd reached a point during my medical school where I was able to think beyond that progression. It was only I decided to do general practice. I felt I had the personality for it. There were some lifestyle factors there that were attractive. It was towards the end of my GP training, I think. I didn't love the job. I didn't relish going to work. There was definitely more I wanted to experience. And I think I suddenly saw the next 40 years ahead of me and realized I wasn't ready to settle down. I'd always had an inkling I wanted to work in low-income countries. And I decided I'd finish my training, have a year to consolidate my knowledge, learn how to be an independent practitioner, and I was going to disappear and try some new things. But I didn't know where anything was going to lead, to be fair.
I certainly know the feeling. And it sounds like India was your first stop on that journey. What took you there? How did you choose that place and that area?
Yeah, India. It was my first foray away working in a new place. At the time, I wasn't really fussy where I went, to be fair to start with. I just had a thirst to explore. I wanted to see how medicine translated into different countries, different cultures. I loved the mountains. I really wanted to be amongst the mountains. I wanted to be remote and in a low resource setting, and I really wanted to be able to immerse myself in whichever culture place I ended up. So I didn't want to be in a big city where I could find home comforts, and I didn't want to be in an expat community at that point in time. I just wanted to go and be somewhere completely different. And I think, to be honest, it was a Google search that got me to India. No, nothing heroic or brave, but just trying to work out where to go and where would have me at the time. So that's how I ended up going. We went to a small state called Uttarakhand, kind of bordering the western border of Nepal up in the Himalayas there. It was phenomenally beautiful, very remote, very low resource setting. So ticked a lot of my boxes. We were the first. There was another physician who I hadn't met until I got there, Sonia, and we were their first Western volunteers. So our roles were pretty loosely defined, I would say. But we were quite mindful of the fact we didn't we didn't want to provide a service that was unsustainable. So if they weren't able to employ a local doctor or secure further volunteers, we didn't want something that we put in place and then to be removed. So we tried very hard to find roles that were sustainable in some form. And so that's where working with the local women's groups, a lot of public health, a lot of medical education. We did a lot of prenatal care and a lot of teaching to some of the motivated women in the communities, how to take blood pressures, how to dip urines, what may trigger the need to refer someone to a higher level of care. The nearest hospital was about 5 hours drive away. And of course, a lot of people didn't have vehicles. So we were a wee way away. So we kind of concentrated a lot on those kind of things, which was fun, I think you think you can conquer the world at that age. And I was pretty naive and didn't realize how big or diverse the world was. So I didn't find India easy. It was a difficult but fun experience. I was young, inexperienced, a long way from home, which was a challenge I wanted, but I wasn't really prepared for what that was going to involve. Life was fun, but completely different. Our neighbour had a cow, so that's how we got our milk, and we'd try and pasteurise it and make milk and butter, and you'd be shooing monkeys at the kitchen area, and you'd shake your shoes out each morning so the scorpions could run out before they bit you on the foot. And you'd go, you know, for a chicken, you'd go down to the local chicken shop and you'd just point at the one you want and the guy would break his neck and hand it to you. And as a city girl, I was used to my meat not representing any form of live animal and being wrapped in cling film. So it was all very, very new for me, but it was fun. Culturally, I was pretty naive. I really didn't realize how different demographics would be treated within the village. There was a very active caste system, and those deemed to be the lowest caste would work, certainly not for money, not even for meals, but just scraps of food, which I found very difficult to understand, you know, that system. And women, there is certainly a lot of gender inequalities and hierarchies within the home. So the women would often, if they were menstruating, they would be in the cowshed, regardless of if it was winter, regardless of the temperature outside. They would often deliver in cowsheds as well. And the daughter-in-law within the house would have no autonomy, even for a simple urine dip in a prenatal check. They could not consent to that themselves. The mother-in-law or the husband needed to be involved. And they were aspects that I'd been vaguely aware of, but not really aware of how impactful that was on a woman's life. And then there was definitely a preference for families to deliver little boys. And the infant mortality rate was relatively high. So people wanted to have two boys in the hope that at least one would make it to adulthood. And it didn't really matter how many education sessions we did about the X and the Y chromosomes. The question we always got from the women was, when am I going to find my Y chromosome? I think they were hard questions to answer. If you did ultrasound scans, you signed a form to say you weren't disclosing the sex, and the woman signed a form saying they didn't ask, and then you would be audited to make sure that the number of live births were about 50% male, 50% female, because feticide was not an uncommon occurrence. So certainly very different to life in the UK. And there was one particular case that really stuck with me, I really struggled with, and my Hindi wasn't great, and it was learnt on the job, and so I'm hoping I didn't understand the whole conversation. But we'd gone down to the village to see a lady we saw fairly regularly, and she had said, oh, my friend delivered, you know, early hours of this morning. She delivered a baby, and it wasn't a lady who had engaged with us. And we'd said, do you think she'd be happy to have a postnatal check? And our lady said, yeah, I think she'd love it. And so she said she's in the next village, which was a 3-hour walk away. So we wandered off to the next village. By the time we arrived, she was about 7 hours post-delivery. And she delivered in the cow shed, and her placenta hadn't been delivered, and she was hemorrhaging pyrexial on the cow shed floor. And she just delivered her third girl. And it took an hour in broken Hindi. And like I say, hopefully I misunderstood some of the conversation, but we had explained how important it was to get this lady to a higher level of care. And the one of the responses we received early in the conversation was, well, if she doesn't make it, we can marry a woman who will give us boys. And I've never forgotten how little someone could value someone else's life. She did go to a high level care and she did fine. She survived. They were interesting experiences to come across. Lots of learning curves for me out there. Lots of learning curves.
Gosh, it sounds incredibly traumatic and incredibly interesting and in such a beautiful place all at once. And, you know, so early on, like you say, you know, in your career, that must have been, you know, both so difficult and sort of educational. Did, you know, after that year, did some of those things influence what you wanted to do next? Did you want to see more of certain things or avoid other aspects?
I certainly didn't want to avoid other aspects at that point. I think every time I've been faced with a situation that I've not known how to deal with or not been comfortable with, I've wanted to learn how to get better at it. So in the sense it drove my thirst for understanding thought processes, understanding contexts and how to integrate good medical care within different cultures, how to communicate better. It gave me, at that point, it gave me a drive to just learn more, get better, do better, understand better. It's the story of a medic's life, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't really end. Yeah, I know the feeling. And after that, you moved, your next, you know, main trip was to Zambia.
Yeah, I went and spent some time in rural Zambia, which was a pretty sweet setup. I had a great time there, although again some challenging experiences, and certainly I for a while I probably wasn't ready to go back to Africa after my time in Zambia. I'd love to now, but I did find that more traumatic in some ways. I was in an area of Zambia called the Luangwa Valley, and there's a number of safari parks there. They are very remote. There's no physician anywhere nearby. So the safari parks are keen to have a physician on standby for any of their clientele, because certainly gastro and malaria are two very real problems that the safari parks experience. So they provided a physician with accommodation and a food allowance and a car and a phone. And the deal was that you would also get unlimited free safaris, but you were on call for the safari park. The only way you could have a license to practice in Zambia was to work in the local government clinic. And that was a small building that had a registered nurse and an LPN equivalent, but no physician. So I would work Monday to Saturday, 8 till 6 in the government clinic. And then outside of that, I was on call for the safari park. And so that was the setup. The government clinic was lovely. It was a building, we had no resources. I think my strongest analgesic was ibuprofen. I had no running water in the clinic. I used to take all my speculums home at night and desperately try and sterilize them to bring them back the next day. And I won't go into the details of how things were stored. But we had a little yellow bike with a trailer on the back of it for patients who are too unwell or too frail to walk to the clinic. And we used to call that our Zambulance. And the nurse would ride off into the village with the Zambulance and bring patients back. And it was fun. It was a very busy clinic, and very interesting medicine. But again, I wasn't really prepared for, you know, certainly not having running water was something I hadn't ever imagined that I would be in a position in a clinic to be, but that's where we were.
Gosh, and any particular cases that stand out from your time in Zambia? As I mentioned in the introduction, it sounds like you had some pretty interesting pathology crop up in amongst the malaria and the gastroenteritis.
I mean, you've worked in Africa, Marcus. You know, you see all those palpable symbols of poverty, HIV, TB, malnutrition, and to a level that you just never see in the UK or in many of the high-income countries. So there was a lot of that. We had a measles epidemic while we were there, and I'd never seen measles before. And of course, a lot of the population were HIV positive as well. So we had a lot of Staph aureus secondary complications and pneumonias. And we had this little shed at the back of the clinic. Our infectious disease management was pretty much kind of all our measles cases got to live in that shed for a while. We ran out of vitamin A, unfortunately, for the children with measles, which was one of the issues. You know, you'd often run out of malaria medications and various medications. And I think that it's very hard when you know there's something you could do and you just don't have the resources. It's very different to where there are no real options. You just know that you're not in a position to give anything that could be life-saving or life-changing. Or cerebral malaria in the little kids was not uncommon and hard. I found that hard, especially, you know, sometimes you come into work and there were more than one case, and how do you, you know, in this, you're trying to manage multiple patients at any one time, and inevitably you don't always get to everyone. It was old school. Anyone who needed intravenous therapy for malaria got quinine and dextrose when I was there. It was we were still very old school. And I remember going to the drug cupboard to get the drugs, thinking my nurse would put an IV line in, and I got back to find her performing an exorcism to remove the spirit. So there were some really interesting combinations of two different cultures meeting and how best to approach an unwell seizing child with cerebral malaria. We didn't always agree, but the croc attacks, there was a lot of domestic violence. The fishermen in the would have croc attacks, and so there was an arm amputation where a croc had jumped up and kind of twisted a gentleman's arm off. You mentioned the hippos carried anthrax. There was actually, the government paid the hippo cullers to cull a number of hippos each year to prevent that anthrax spreading into the other animal populations. But the fishermen, again, would often come in with the cutaneous anthrax as a result. So that was very interesting. You know, I'd never barely even read about it, to be fair, I imagine, but I certainly didn't know a huge amount about it. So that was very interesting. It really interesting medicine. A guy got wheeled in a wheelbarrow, and I thought he must have been incredibly unwell. He was young, but it was just that his testicle was bigger than the biggest watermelon I've ever seen, and he couldn't walk. And yeah, there was the sexually transmitted infections out there were a whole range of new for me. But it was a fascinating place.
Sounds incredible. What some absolute experiences. And it sounds you were seeing such a breadth of pathology, like you say, things that you perhaps, you know, had heard of, but not much more, all the way through to very unwell children and patients of all ages. And I suspect, again, that, you know, arm amputation wasn't something that was in the GP portfolio when you did it. Certainly wasn't when I did it a couple of years ago. You know, so many difficult and as you say, sort of traumatic experiences. How was it at the time dealing with that personally? How, you know, have things been since? And any advice to anyone looking to do similar roles or sort of looking ahead to their career? How would you maybe do things differently or look after yourself differently?
Yeah, it's a great question. one I wish I had a great answer to. It deserves one, but I'm probably lacking it in my response. I certainly wasn't prepared. Does anything prepare you for that? I'm not sure. At the time, you know, this is almost 15 years ago, and so I didn't have access to many of the phenomenal resources we have now, and certainly there's still not great internet access in a lot of remote locations, but that was not something that was present at all. So all those wonderful medical apps and things that can give you some support, I just had the old school books. But make sure you have an element of that. I was early in my career. I now have a whole host of people at the other end of a phone that I could call for advice. But I hadn't formed those networks at that point. It was difficult. No one else worked in the clinic with me. No one at home. It's very hard to explain exactly what it was like working there. And I don't think I did deal with it very well, actually. You get on with it while you're there. And I came home, and it would have been years before I'd have been ready to go back to Africa. And I think that was probably that I just slowly processed everything and worked on my clinical skills and my medical knowledge. And I'd love to go back now, but I feel I have many more years under my belt, and have the capacity to approach things and the resilience to deal with it. I think it's just been a long process for me to learn how to get there. So make sure you've got your support networks. I think be able to debrief, and I think that's the most important thing anywhere in medicine, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think we could talk about each place you've been for quite a long time, but moving on now. When I first heard about your involvement with Everest ER, I think I look back to many, many hours watching the BBC series, and have to say I think that's probably one of the things that took my career, luckily, to Everest, although be it the other side, and certainly one of the things that I always, through my training, looked on as something I'd love to do. And I'd love to hear what was the clinic like. I know you worked with Luan Freer, as I said, someone who's been pretty instrumental in sort of Himalayan healthcare. Tell us all about Everest.
Expedition medicine just lands you in some of the most beautiful and remote parts of the world and introduces you to phenomenal people, doesn't it? Like Luan, who is a phenomenal human being and a great mentor. Everest, as far as expedition medicine goes, Everest was slightly different in the sense that there's 1,000 people at base camp during the climbing season. Half of those will climb and half of them will be base camp staff. So doctors, base camp managers, porters, cooks. And your traditional population in the expedition world will be the healthy, wealthy clients. But actually, you know, on Everest, you had a lot of Nepalese. And although the Sherpa are relatively wealthy in Nepali standards, a lot of base camp staff weren't Sherpa, were lowland Nepalese who came from impoverished backgrounds. So we had that really nice mix of different cultures, different socioeconomic demographics, a wealth of stories, different beliefs. And it was nice to have that range of medicine as a result of that. Everest ER is a not-for-profit, so we would volunteer our services, and the Western climbers would essentially pay for their input from ourselves, and with that money we could see the Nepalese relatively free of charge. So that's how the clinic worked. It was a great setup, you know. I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of hurry up and wait in expedition medicine. You're kind of ready for things to happen, and I got very good at poker, I think, while I was there. But there's a lot of motivational chats, you know. People have built themselves up, they've gotten funding, they've gotten sponsorship, they've created blogs, they're raising money for charities. There's this huge amount of pressure before they've even arrived at base camp to succeed in this challenge that is incredibly difficult, and they get to the mountain. And not only is the physical aspect of it difficult, but it's psychologically, I mean, they say it's 90% psychology, don't they, climbing the mountain, and psychologically challenging. And so there's a lot of kind of motivational chats. Either you can do this, or sometimes people actually just needed someone else to call it for them, because it was too much for them to call it themselves. That was too great a ask, but they psychologically couldn't do it for whatever reason. So there was an interesting psychology on the mountain. People at base camp are acclimatized, you know. So we didn't see a lot of altitude medicine at base camp. That happened higher on the mountain, and we deal with that by radio. So the acute mountain sickness, or the HACE, or the HAPE, a lot of the hypothermia, that would all be done via the radio. By the time they'd gotten back to us at base camp, a lot of that had been dealt with. Medically, there was a range. The Sherpa like to perforate ulcers on the mountain. So, you know, I'm sure they're endemic for H. pylori. A lot of them smoke, high levels of tannins in their tea. And then you've got stress and hypoxia on top of that, which I'm sure a lot of them have peptic ulcer disease before they climbed. And then that perfect cocktail of issues caused perforations. We saw a fair amount of alcohol withdrawal. I think people, when they were at home, would potentially drink, and then they'd come to work at base camp and the alcohol would suddenly stop. So that wasn't uncommon in the Nepali population either. So we'd see that. There's a famous story, I wasn't there, but in 2009, about a methanol poisoning from local methylated spirits that I believe was treated very well with some high quality Russian vodka, but I... it's a myth that goes around base camp, but I think it's true. And then the climbers, you'd see frostbite, you'd see myocardial infarctions, you'd see strange arrhythmias, transformed migraines, unusual neurological symptoms. It's amazing what hypoxia can do to people. Pulmonary emboli, frostbite, lots of frostbite. Trauma. So it was an interesting mix that we'd see up there. It was fun.
And how many seasons did you do? How many times did you return?
So I did 2009 at the HRA in Feriche, and then 2011, 2012, and 2013 on Everest. Three seasons, two for the Himalayan Rescue Association, and then one for a commercial climbing company.
Brilliant. I'm very jealous. So we've already covered a couple of continents already, and you've worked all over the world. I know you now live in BC with your partner and children. I'd love to know how raising a family has worked with such diverse and often remote medicine.
Yeah, my career's been a very fluid entity, I would say, an ever-evolving wheel. My partner is a Everest and high-altitude mountain guide. So before children, we were very used to being apart for long periods of time. That it was normal for us. We're fairly independent souls, and it worked well. Since having children, it's definitely changed. Expedition and humanitarian work, if they pay, don't pay well, but generally aren't paid positions. And so it's one thing to do it when you're only responsible for yourself, but if you're filling your own bucket and not putting any food on the table for the rest of the family, that's a little harder. I found that harder to justify. So I managed to find a job here in Canada, in Nunavut, which essentially gives me a lot of the similar kind of aspects, that remote and rural medicine that I love and that I can earn a living from. And I keep my hand in with shorter expeditions. So I tend to just go away for a couple of weeks at a time. I've joined a disaster response register, which only involves us being deployed for 2 to 4 weeks. So that I keep feeding my soul, but I'm not really taking away too much from the family. I struggle, if I'm working, I'm working. I'm sure a lot of medics find this. I struggle to switch it off. it's a vocation and not a job, really, isn't it? It's a way of life. So I have tried to work in the community I live in, and I come home and I'm still at work. And there's always something I can check, something I can do, someone I need to phone, results I need to sign off. And I was a terrible mum and I was a terrible partner. I was never present. I was always stressed. I never made any of the kids' school stuff. And so as a family, we actually decided they'd prefer it if I just went away. They wouldn't expect to see me. I could go and do my job and do it to the level that I felt comfortable with, rather than feeling I was compromising in all aspects, work and play and family. So I go now for 2 weeks at a time, put my head down, do my work. I don't have anything else to do. And then I come home and I can be at home and be mum. And I have much better quality time. The house is nicer, much less stressed. No one's dealing with someone on shift work. So for us, that works. I appreciate it's an individual.
Sounds like an excellent balance. And an interesting thought process to actually find the pattern that works best for you. And something I suppose we're quite lucky in medicine to be able to do. We're going to come to Canada. I'm looking forward to hearing all about your Canadian work. But before that, you spent considerable time in Antarctica. What were you doing out there?
I did a couple of different roles in Antarctica. Some of it's just been on the peninsula, kayaking around the icebergs and watching the wildlife. But I suppose the most enjoyable time I spent was on the continent, supporting the transantarctic skiers and the Vincent climbers and the various different mountains in Antarctica. I think there was a transantarctic fat biker and there's some kite skiers and so supporting any of those expeditions, really. We were based at a place called Union Glacier, but as the medics, we were incredibly fortunate. I got to travel to the South Pole and we'd often go to Vincent Base Camp and, Camp 1 on Vincent would need supplies, so we'd skin up and drop them off and ski down. And I remember sitting, the toilet at Base Camp was obviously a barrel with a three ice walls. And I remember sitting on it, looking out at this vast expanse of mountains and snow and ice. And you couldn't really work out where the land finished and the sky started. And I don't know if you remember, I might be showing my age here. There was an advert for a beer company. And they always said, if so-and-so did karaoke and the guy was on a stadium and it was the best karaoke ever. And I just remember thinking, if that beer company did toilets, they were the best toilets I've ever seen. Be it a barrel, but it was the most beautiful view. It was phenomenal.
Incredible. What a job takes you to Vincent Base Camp just to drop off a few supplies and pop far the world's most not glamorous, but the world's most scenic toilet is the word I'm looking for. Goodness me. And what kind of clinic were you operating out of and what were you seeing medically?
I got very good at debriding and dressing blisters. there was a lot of that. Very similar to Everest, except that I didn't have the Nepali population. So it was all expedition kind of members. So the healthy, wealthy. Frostbite. We actually saw a condition, we called it polar thigh, that had never been documented in any of kind of the Shackleton books, and they documented everything. But the transantarctic skiers would develop lesions on their thighs, possibly a mixture of friction from the clothing and cold related. It started like chilblains, but it would break down if you didn't deal with it into necrotic ulcers. It was pretty nasty. It was often a reason for us to pull people off their expedition. So they didn't like to tell us about it because they didn't want to get pulled off. But it was interesting. It didn't respond to, say, aloe vera, which we often use in frostbite in the wilderness, but it did, in the early stages, did respond to steroid creams. I'd love someone to go out and biopsy it and look under the microscope at it. But so definitely some things that seem to be unique. And we kite skiers toe, we called it, the kite skiers would have their dominant foot forward, and that their great toe would always get frostbitten. Well, not always, but often, you know. So a variation of Antarctic medical issues, and then the usual in any camp setting, ERTEs, gastro, everything that would run rife through a camp setting.
Well, there's a if there's any dermatologists listening, there's an expedition research trip to undertake.
Please.
Yeah, get to grips with polar thigh. I'm surprised didn't want to name kite skier's toe, gen toe, or anything like that. Eponymous.
The pond toe.
Yeah.
No, I feel excellent. Like someone else deserves to take that title. I wasn't the first to say it for sure.
Excellent. So as we mentioned already, now based in Canada, and your work takes you up to far north Canada, to Nunavut, working with the indigenous Inuit population. And you've already touched a little bit on what attracted you up there, but could you tell us a bit more about, yeah, how did you come across such a job, and what does it involve when you're up there for your 2 to 4 week stints?
Yeah, I suppose I'm always looking for that remote, rural. I like to put myself outside of my comfort zone. I'm not sure why, but seems to be what I enjoy doing. So we'd moved to Canada really because my other half is a Kiwi, and we've been in New Zealand for a while, and it's a long way from the UK, and I really wanted my parents to have more input with their grandkids. So we chose somewhere with mountains and lakes and skiing and biking and all the things we enjoyed. That was the main reason to move to Canada. And then once we were here, I realized that there were these amazing opportunities to go up to the Arctic and work with the Inuit population and provide medicine up there, which, as you can imagine from our conversation, it was probably my jam. So we're so privileged, aren't we, in medicine? Like we have so many opportunities. We can go into so many different places and meet so many phenomenal people. And yet the nature of our profession means that people tend to trust us. They let us into their lives. They tell us their fears, their secrets, what they're ashamed of, what they're scared of, and trust us to advocate for them. And it's such a privilege to be able to travel the world and have people let you in like that, you know. I think I've diverged, but yeah. So I realized that I could practice the type of medicine I enjoyed up in Nunavut and experience a whole new culture. It's remote. We're generally single-handed. It depends in what part of the territory you're in. There's some areas that would have a couple of doctors, and Iqaluit on Baffin Island has a CT scanner and a hospital, so it's very well stocked. But most of the communities are small, difficult, logistically very difficult to get into, generally have to fly in. And you'll be a single-handed physician with normally a great, but small team. So some registered nurses, acute care paramedics, occasionally a nurse practitioner, and that's you, and then you'll deal with whatever walks through the door because you kind of got to, but yeah.
and what has walked through the door? Any particular cases that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, for a high-income country like Canada, none of it feels more like working in a low-income country at times. We're very resource poor. I don't have a lab. I have some iStat machines. I don't have a ventilator. I don't have BiPAP. I don't have CPAP. I occasionally have X-ray, but not always. And that would just be chest and peripheries. So we're limited. I had a gentleman who, slightly inebriated after an argument with his wife, shot himself through the left side of the chest. And fortunately, missed one vital organ, but gave himself a good human pneumothorax. And then I had a lady who came in active labor at 30 weeks, and the baby needed a full recess. Multiple codes, often, and we've often done well and gotten RASC, but then you can wait, it's to anywhere up to 3 days to get someone out, and you know, so they're on pressors and amiodarone infusions and all the rest of it, and you haven't got a ventilator, you're bagging this person for until the plane can come. It's not what you'd expect in a high-income country, but so we have some interesting cases. I think the last one I had, fortunately, she didn't. So if someone's over 4 centimeters, we can't fly them out. At that point, they're delivering. Sorry if they're in a pregnancy. I did, last time we were there, I had a lady who was 24 plus 3, came in niggling. So she was 2 centimeters. She was complex. She had chronic kidney disease and hypertension, was already on nifedipine. And it took 3 days to get her out. And part of the problem was that weather's often an issue, so the planes can't fly. But then the plane could fly, but then no one in the community had gone to the, who was in charge of doing the weather, had gone to the airport to do the weather. So we, you know, spend our time knocking on doors in the community to get someone to come report the weather so that the planes can leave. In this case, I think it was Yellowknife. It had to leave to get up to us. And you know, the journey, the shortest will be, it take them 5 hours to get to us if they can leave straight away. And, you know, and then they've got to package the patient and get back down. And often where I am on the kind of western side of Nunavut, we would send people to Yellowknife who, and they don't have full resources. So this lady would then have to go on to Edmonton and Alberta. So the long distances, we're talking about transferring people. And we're often left hoping, you know, trying to manage them until that plane can get in. So it's interesting. I feel like we play a very perverse game of who wants to be a millionaire. You know, you kind of, you do your differential. So you got your 50-50. And then you ask the audience, and eventually you phone a friend. And I feel like that's the story with every patient I see. But we have the resources, unlike in Africa. You know, I have people at the other end of a phone, and the support in Canada is amazing. People are great, and like, people will get onto Zoom and talk you through procedures. And with that 30-week, like, an entire NICU team was on the video talking us through everything. So you are alone, but you're not, you know, you have great supports. So it's fun. I'm sure it's not good for my blood pressure a lot of the time, but it's a really rewarding place to work. But it's tough. I think, you know, TB in Nunavut is 300 times the rate of a non-Indigenous Canadian. It's huge. We certainly have some palpable markers of poverty up there. Malnutrition, TB, overcrowding, high smoking rates, and then lots of, you know, genetic subarachnoid hemorrhages are common, and cardiomyopathies are common, lots of seizure disorders. So it's an interesting population, lots of medicine.
Sounds absolutely fascinating and so broad. I think often personally, when I think about some of these remote and rural jobs I'd like to do, I kind of always forget the obstetrics. And actually, you know, it really sounds like you're dealing with absolutely everything there, the full breadth. Yeah, goodness. And what's the population like? So how many people are you looking after?
Yeah, again, depends on the community. The community I tend to work in, we have 1,400 people as the population. And they will have a physician in community for 1 week of every month. So it's you know, not what you call fully serviced, but some of the larger communities will have a couple of physicians there all the time. But yeah, kind of anywhere from 500 to 1600, most of the communities vary amongst those kind of sizes, I would say. So not huge, but not tiny for being on 24/7.
Yeah, certainly enough people for things to go wrong, especially when you've got, I suppose, the difference to other places perhaps is that actually that population doesn't sound perhaps as fit and well as they could be, or a high burden of disease, which at any point could become a bit more acute and need quite a lot of care.
Yeah, lots of decompensation for sure of chronic
Yeah.
diseases. Absolutely.
So we kind of, if we look back, we started out having a chat about what you wanted to do in your career as you looked forward, and when you look back now, you must be, I mean, incredibly proud of some of the things you've done. I mean, absolutely, in really inspiring to hear the things you've done and how you've handled it, and sounds like you really have gone from each one, really built on those skills that you learned, and sort of turned yourself into this sort of consummate clinician that I think there are not many of nowadays, for sure. Really quite amazing. How does it compare when you look back to what you perhaps set out to do, and what kind of plans have you got looking ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't regret any of my career choices. I've had the most fantastic career. I've met phenomenal people. I've had great experiences. I wouldn't change anything. I mean, we practice evidence-based medicine, don't we? It's a very scientific-based profession, but wherever you are in the world, actually, it's the art of delivering the science that I find one of the true skills. You have to know what your diagnosis is to deliver that evidence-based medicine, and it's the art of eliciting that story and understanding, interpreting the symptoms and what people mean, and then I never have the gold standard management plans at hand. There's no cath lab near me or a CT scanner. So hot strokes wouldn't get thrombolysis, let alone thrombectomies. And so then the art of negotiating the best possible management plan with what you have. So I've really enjoyed it. I'm really enjoying what I'm doing at the moment. I love working in the Arctic. Whilst the kids are young, I'd like to keep my hand in with the disaster response register, and when they decide to grow up and flee the nest, I think I'd probably enjoy the opportunity to do some more humanitarian work on more longer term bases. But for now, I feel I have a really nice mix of work and life with a really fulfilling kind of job, and that leaves room for lots of opportunities. So yeah, I'm really happy with where I'm at. And then with the plan to evolve more humanitarian work as life allows, I suppose.
Brilliant. I think a lot of people be very inspired by what you've done and hearing all about it. Any advice for those setting out to emulate or follow a career quite as diverse and extreme as you've had?
I think just follow your passions, look for things, take opportunities, other opportunities inevitably occur. Without wanting to be reckless, don't get scared by the system. I can't leave my specialty training. I can't, I feel like a lot of us feel constrained by those elements. And I have plenty of friends who did leave specialty training and have had wonderful adventures and have gone back and finished their specialty training without a problem. Yeah, don't have any expectations. Just go with the flow, and then make sure you've got your support networks behind you. But just go and enjoy it. Look for things if you want to, and there's so many opportunities out there. We're so lucky. We have this profession that's transferable into every place, with every person, with every culture. It's such a phenomenal privilege. Take advantage of it, learn from it.
Thank you for that. That's been really, genuinely really interesting and inspiring, like I said. Jen, if anyone wanted to get in touch with you, is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, they can get me on my email, which is jpferney@gmail.com. They can get me on that email if they want.
Smashing. I'm sure we can put that in the show notes as well. Well, thanks again. It's been brilliant. And Jen mentioned before we started recording that she was very nervous. But I think you'll all agree that an absolute natural podcast guest and a real pleasure to have on the WEM podcast. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Marcus. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.